And hello there. Welcome to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Phil Latzman. Good to have you along. Our weekly mission to keep South Florida and the region informed on local, regional, state news and issues affecting our community from Key West to Tallahassee with a panel of the area's top journalists. And this week they are an official introduction to Tom Hudson. You've heard on the air here hosting a series of programs called The Sunshine Economy. Another one is taking place on Monday at 9 a.m., and he'll be talking about that. He's the former co-host and managing editor of Public Television's Nightly Business Report. Tom, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me along here, Phil.
Karen Burkett is another familiar voice that you hear on this radio station. She is the host of the Miami Herald's weekly business report that you hear Fridays at 5:45 p.m. and works at the Miami Herald as a longtime I'm a journalist in television and now in radio. And Karen, we welcome you back as well.
Thank you so much for having me.
Trevor Aronson is also a returnee. He is associate director and co-founder of the Florida Center for Investigative Reporting, and he joins us from Tallahassee. Trevor, good to have you here.
Thanks, Phil. Glad to be here.
So let's jump right in to the big story of the day. And we're going to keep focused on the economy here in the state of Florida. And that's a part of what Tom's been doing during his programs. We'll sort of take the 30,000-foot view of things here and start with the unemployment numbers, which we just got this morning. And the rate keeps dropping. The state today announced the jobless rate had dropped to 7.2% in April. The new figures announced on the Twitter account that Governor Rick Scott has set up, at It's Working FL, set up by the Scott administration. Most of the gains statewide were in construction and goods producing. Construction adding 7,500 jobs. Goods producing adding more than 6,000 jobs month to month. The new unemployment rate, the lowest it's been since 2008, September of 2008. Governor Scott calling the latest figures great news for Florida's families. It dropped from 7.5 to 7.2%. Trevor, first of all, we've heard the governor trying to take credit for this, and you know, is he getting traction on this "Let's Get to Work" pledge with the unemployment rate dropping?
Well, obviously, the economy is improving and unemployment has improved significantly. I think the question is how much of this is due to Scott's pretty aggressive economic policies. I mean, one thing to keep in mind about unemployment figures in Florida is that, you know, the jobs are that are being created under Scott are not necessarily the ones that are worth bragging about. These often are lower paying jobs without any great benefits. And so while the numbers are showing an improvement, it's not really improving for, you know, the really desirable jobs that a state would want to create. Instead, it tends to be the lower level jobs that have lower pay and few, if any, benefits.
Tom Hudson?
Yeah, one of the other pieces of this that we're not seeing quite yet is the income, what these folks are actually getting paid. Trevor makes a great point that the kinds of jobs that we've seen created certainly recently over the last couple of months have been, generally speaking, usually seasonal jobs, hospitality jobs, those kind of things. But seeing construction jobs come back in the state, that's a positive, certainly. We also have seen manufacturing jobs come back in the state. We've seen government jobs, though, continue to decrease. And those government jobs, Phil, usually come with a pretty good paycheck and a lot of decent pension benefits, too.
Regionally, the numbers are as follows. Broward's rate down slightly, still pretty low at 5.6% comparatively to the rest of the state. Miami-Dade's non-seasonally adjusted rate is now 8.8%, so still a disparity there between counties. Palm Beach County is down a tick to 6.8%. Monroe County, which does not have the job force, the labor force that the rest of the state does, and obviously not as much population, but it's the lowest in the state in the Keys at 3.7%. Karen Burkett.
I wanted to add, too, that in the healthcare sector in Miami-Dade, they have shed 1,600 jobs since October, and the healthcare sector has been an engine just that we could count on
right,
for
we
this
thought
county
that would
in particular.
Be growing, right?
Absolutely. And they've had a 59-month streak of adding jobs, and it's slowed. So that's something to kind of keep an eye on.
We're going to talk about healthcare, and that was the topic of the Sunshine Economy program this past Monday with Tom. Now, It's Working has been the motto that Governor Rick Scott has been using now for the past few months as he tries to put his platform forward in Tallahassee, his efforts to bring jobs and business to the state, the It's Working slogan. We talked a little bit about, Trevor, whether he deserves the credit for this and whether these are the kinds of jobs that you want, though Governor Scott has recently lured Hertz to Florida, and we've gotten some news about some other companies moving to the state and some companies that are not moving to the state. But his efforts, Trevor, to bring new business to the state, are they paying off?
They are. The question is, at what price? You know, when you look at the Hertz deal, like here's a company that decided to move its headquarters from New Jersey and was lured to Florida through the offering of $19 million in economic incentives to build a new headquarters in the Fort Myers area. What's troubling about it, however, is that, it, like a lot of economic incentives, the process by which they're awarded is very opaque. You know, for example, the Lee County commissioners had to vote to approve that incentive, and they didn't know which company was going to get these millions of dollars until well after they had voted. And I think that raises a troubling trend. I mean, what we're seeing is that, you know, Rick Scott, like his predecessors, Jeb Bush and Charlie Crist, has been really aggressive in offering economic incentives to companies to move to the state or expand in the state. You know, in his first 2 years in office, Rick Scott offered $130 million in economic incentives. What's unclear, though, and what groups like Integrity Florida question is how many of these jobs would have been created through natural economic growth rather than, you know, through the spurring of growth through these economic incentives. And I think that's really unclear. And I think, you know, this is where, you know, the news media and Floridians should really be questioning is where all this money is going, how this money is largely benefiting large publicly traded corporations, and how it's still unclear whether these millions of dollars are creating jobs that otherwise would not have been created in the natural growth of the economy.
Tom, you want to jump in?
Yeah, now the argument, of course, Trevor, from the community will be that these will be good paying jobs, decent paying jobs. This is an increase in the payroll for these local communities. But what happens here, Trevor and Phil and Karen, is that anytime you get government offering incentives, it distorts the marketplace is what happens here. And it really kind of messes with the normal economics of attracting businesses, luring businesses, and creating jobs. And you don't create an even playing field. Now, listen, Governor Scott, like all 49 other governors, are competing not only against each other for these large corporations, clean jobs, good paying jobs, but they're also competing nationally and internationally for these kinds of jobs creation. But what happens with these government incentives is it just distorts the marketplace, and it distorts pricing, not only in terms of the payroll for these people who are getting jobs, but it distorts the pricing for the consumer ultimately that's going to consume the goods or services.
Now, we also found out this week that Amazon.com, which is a huge, obviously, online retailer, and the founder of Amazon.com, Jeff Bezos, is from Miami, went to high school here, and I think is a distinguished alum of Miami-Dade County Schools. But Florida Governor Rick Scott rejecting a proposed deal to bring Amazon.com to the state, and this would have created about 2,500 jobs in the state. Tom, you have some insight on as to why he decided not to do that.
This is really interesting because technically it would have met a tax increase for any Floridian ordering anything on Amazon.com, because the way that the rules are right now is if the retailer, online retailer, has a physical presence, either a store or in this case an Amazon warehouse in the state, then that retailer has to charge whatever state and local sales taxes are applicable. So right now, I know when I order, when my wife orders on Amazon.com, we're able to essentially get something for less expensive than if we order it from an online retailer that has a presence here in the Sunshine State. So that was ostensibly the reason why they didn't want to attract. Now, all of this could be fixed with some legislation that's been pending in Washington,
though. Yeah, and then there's always the brick-and-mortar retailers out there that are wondering, hey, people are paying sales tax. Amazon.com is not. We're not getting that business. You know, Trevor, there's been discussions about trying to collect on the internet sales tax in Florida. It is the law, but you have to report it, but nobody actually enforces it. And that was, again, something that was discussed during the session this year, but has not been resolved.
Right. I think, you know, as Tom pointed out with the incentives, this is another example of really distorting the marketplace in the sense that you could buy the same thing from Amazon that you could at Best Buy online. But if you order it at Best Buy, you're going to pay the 6 or 7% sales tax, depending on what county you're in. But with Amazon, you won't. So it does create an unfair market system. And that creates a system where I think, you know, that the only real resolution for that is for something on the federal level where we pass a law that applies nationwide, as opposed to the hodgepodge of laws we have with the states, where some states collect on sales tax based on whether the company has an operation there.
And as Tom alluded to, the Congress is debating whether to allow states to collect sales taxes on internet purchases right now. Karen, you want to put a...
And we have to recognize also a little bit of political timing. This could have all come about shortly before he was running for re-election. And he has said before that he only supports taxes on internet purchases if they're offset by taxes elsewhere. So that's a factor in this.
The governor was on tour this week. He was here in Miami. He was in Jacksonville. He, I think, is spending some time in Tampa on a tour touting victory on a big agenda item for him. One of the agenda items was the across-the-board raises for teachers, which he mentioned in the State of the State a couple of months ago. The other one was the elimination of a sales tax on manufacturing equipment.
When a manufacturing company doesn't have to pay this sales tax any longer when they buy machinery and equipment, one, they can put those dollars into hiring more people. They can put more dollars into marketing, more dollars into research and development.
So is this really a big deal? I mean, is this a some people look at this and go, well, this is just trying to get tax breaks for big companies.
You know, Phil, I mean, it could be a big deal for any individual company that's looking for this kind of capital outlay, this kind of big ticket item, certainly. And is it going to necessarily move a corporate headquarters from New Jersey down to Florida? Probably not. But for those Floridian-based manufacturers, yeah, this could be a big deal. And it's a key constituency here politically because manufacturing has been on the back end of this job growth. Hasn't really participated in the job growth that we mentioned earlier.
And we should clarify that on the income tax, the sales tax, rather, as far as the internet sales tax, customers were always supposed to pay it. It's just a matter of collecting it, which they have not been doing. All right, so we're going to take a break here. When we come back, there's some really, really good news as far as tourism is concerned. It's the number one industry in the state. Those numbers, along with the jobless numbers we saw and some real estate numbers, we'll talk about that as well, really looking up for the state of Florida, and we'll discuss whether that is real or not. Is this a bubble that's about to burst in real estate? Are the tourism numbers going to stick? Can we count on those in the future? So our special Florida Roundup program, we're talking about the economy and business, and we'll talk about a whole lot more. Tom Hudson, Karen Burkett, Trevor Aronson, Phil Latzman, we're back in just a moment. And I'm Phil Latzman. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. Thanks for joining us. Our guests, Karen Burkett from the Miami Herald and the host of our weekly business report here on WLRN, here every Friday. Tom Hudson, the former anchor for the nightly business report, now with WLRN Miami Herald News, hosting a series of shows called The Sunshine Economy. Trevor Aronson from the Florida Center for Investigative Reporting. This is usually the time we like to give out our Twitter addresses for those who have other questions. And the conversation, by the way, continues off the air. We have our online social media editor, Danny Rivera, who's actually in there typing very quickly to cultivate the discussion online on our website, WLRN.org. There's a live blog happening there. And we're also always available on Twitter. I think we all have our Twitter accounts. Trevor, what's yours?
Trevor Aronson has one word, and Aronson is A-A-R-O-N-S-O-N.
Karen?
At KB Miami.
Tom?
At Hudson's View.
And I'm at Phil Latzman, L-A-T-Z-M-A-N. So we did talk as we went into the break there about the tourism numbers, and this is certainly eye-catching numbers we heard about this week. State tourism officials say more people visited Florida in the first 3 months of 2013 than any other quarter in the state's history. Visit Florida announced Wednesday preliminary numbers show 26 million people came to Florida. Visitors came to Florida in January, February, and March. That is an increase of nearly 5% over the same period in 2012. Now, not to get too numbery here, but there are now 1,087,700 Floridians employed in the tourism industry. That is a record high. That's also more than 3% over what it was last year. There's been apparently 36,000 jobs added in tourism in 1 year alone. So these are encouraging numbers. So Karen, you want to take
that
first?
I would say too that tourism is sort of the first part of this economic matrix. That's the place that it recovered first, and then you saw real estate, and then you're starting to see more with unemployment. So that's the place that's been sturdy. That's where people started spending first.
But then again, Tom, these are not the kinds of jobs that are going to make people rich.
Not a number of them, no, but they can be steady, decent-paying gigs, medium incomes of somewhere $30,000 to $80,000 in some cases. We've got a program coming up on the Sunshine Economy in June looking at the tourism industry and a conversation with a large hotel CEO here in town that actually is frustrated that he doesn't have enough native Floridians to fill his jobs, that he's got to go out of state, actually out of country, to find people who want to work in hospitality because it has this kind of thought that it's not a really good paying or long lasting job.
More figures from Visit Florida, which is the state's official tourism agency. In 2012, visitation numbers in the state, 91.4 million people came from elsewhere to come here. That figure includes 76.6 77.6 million domestic visitors, 10.2 million overseas travelers, and most of them coming from Canada, with the 3.6 million coming from north of the border. Trevor, Visit Florida, very proud of these numbers as they release them this week.
Absolutely. You know, I think this probably is indicative of the wider economic recovery. I mean, I think people are looking at their retirement funds and their 401ks, and they realize that it's gone up considerably. There's much more consumer confidence, and there's a greater willingness among Americans to take vacations. And Florida, obviously, is among the premier vacation spots. I think the great side of this, too, is to keep in mind how much revenue the state government collects in tourism taxes, mm-hmm. and how, you know, a rebound in tourism is really going to be a good thing for a state government that's been pretty anemic in finances the last few years.
So let's turn to real estate now. Real estate prices recently came out for our area, and again, more good news. We found out that prices have gone up year to year by 25% or more in Miami-Dade, Broward, and Palm Beach. Karen, this is one of the big focuses on your beat as the host of the Friday Business Report.
Absolutely.
Here on WLRN. Now, recently, you spoke with Ron Shuffield, the president of one of the largest real estate brokers in the region, EWM, and here's what he said about the market right now.
Well, in one word, it's booming again. We've seen the stats roll back about 10 years. Our inventories are similar looking. Sales are similar looking. We're probably on track now to sell more homes and condominiums in Miami this year than we've ever sold in history.
So why are things going so well right now?
Well, values are up. Prices are up. Inventory is very, very tight. The luxury market is coming here. We've been talking about reporting about international buyers, all cash buyers coming in for a long time. And now actually folks are coming in from California and New York working to change their tax situation. And they're buying luxury properties. He deals with the luxury market, but it is spreading across to other markets.
But there's a cautionary tale, right?
Yes. If you're basically the thing is that if you're trying to get into the market and you're trying to buy, you're seeing these prices go up, and he's a bit concerned about that.
You've made comments about the health of the market and saying you're not comfortable with the pace of prices rising the way they are. Why do you say that?
Of course, been doing this for a long time, and when you start seeing increases that are averaging 2% a month, it's just not, you know, I would prefer that those increases be less than that. You know, it'd be great if we could have an increase at the end of this year that was under 10%, but we probably are going to have something significantly greater than that. Now, at the same time I say that, I'm not too concerned because we found ourselves in such a deep, dark hole there for a few years. We overcorrected by lowering the prices too much, and so we need to catch up now to kind of where we should be.
So where should we be? I mean, I guess the question is, should all of our homes that we bought, should those values be up to where they were in 2006?
Well, there are definitely going to be different factors that could affect the market. Right now, if you're a buyer, interest rates are still very low, and you feel great about that. That's something that's motivating you to get into the market. But what happens if that interest rate goes up? And it will. So that's going to change the dynamics of things.
And has it been all around? Has it been the lower end and the higher end homes? Or is it hard to tell what's been going up?
I would say that it is now getting into all markets. The luxury sector did rebound quickly. But if you go to Homestead, if you go to Doral, if you go to Kendall, and I'm certainly not calling them lower end, but that's where
The non-millionaire.
Yes, yeah. The non-millionaires live. Those values are doing better.
And Tom, you, in fact, in the next installment of the Sunshine Economy series on Monday at 9 a.m. here on WLRN, you're going to be focusing on the new real estate boom and give us a preview of what you'll be talking about.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. One of our guests, John Canis, who's the chairman and CEO of Bank United, a bank that's based in Miami Lakes, says accurately and commonsensically, the story of Florida is the story of real estate, and we're living that story, as Karen just mapped out for us, on the good side of it, but we've lived through some very dark days. And the Bank United CEO, who's seen a lot of different markets in his career as a banker, is more than just a little surprised about how fast this South Florida real estate market has rebounded.
We're at least impressed, if not amazed, at how quickly this thing has turned around. When I moved onto Brickell Avenue 4 years ago and started trying to find a restaurant that was open on a Friday night to eat in where there was at least four or five customers. It has been a head-turning turnaround and sort of a jaw-dropping change of events.
So, but I hate to be the spoiler here, but we still see the figures that come out every month about foreclosures. Florida and Miami and this area is still near the worst in the country as far as foreclosures are concerned. So we're not out of the woods as far as that.
No, far from it. And I think that's a really important point here, Phil, is that the market recovery that we've seen is beginning to spread to kind of more to broader markets, but it's still a lumpy recovery. I mean, we see low inventories that has helped increase those median home prices that get reported, but hundreds of thousands of Floridians, not only here in South Florida, but across the state, remain stuck in their mortgages, underwater. They owe more on their mortgages than their homes could still sell for today, despite those 10-12% price increases that we've seen.
That would include me. Yeah. Underwater right here.
Yeah, well, and as you're not alone, obviously, a lot of people. There is a foreclosure bill that is on Governor Scott's desk, a consumer advocacy group calling on him to veto this legislation. It's aimed at accelerating the foreclosure process because it takes away some of the homeowners' rights to contest foreclosures. It's another decision on the veto docket for Governor Scott, Trevor. Aronson.
That's right. I mean, I think one of the concerns now with a bill like this is that there were already so many abuses from the banks, and you know the robo signing of the foreclosure foreclosures, for example. That I think you know allowing the banks to have an easier process in foreclosing certainly raises some troubling issues for consumers.
All right, Victoria is on the line with us from Fort Lauderdale, who has some comments about this foreclosure bill. Victoria, welcome to the Florida Roundup.
Oh, thank you very much. I wanted to talk today a little bit about this bill, the HB 87, which is, I can't believe, with Florida's state of high foreclosures, and noted that all the fines that the banks from one and mortgage servicers have had to pay in to all the residents, why would our legislatures want to submit a bill that's going to hinder the homeowners more than they already are? It's beyond me, and the worst about the bill is that it neglects due process, basically. I wish I was a lawyer. I could talk a little bit better about...
Sounds like you know what you're talking about, though.
Well, a little bit, because just like you two, I am underwater in my mortgage, so I have been researching this for quite a while. And my mortgage is supposedly owned by the infamous Lehman Brothers.
Mm-hmm.
So... they're the ones that crashed our economy. How much more is needed to be said on this?
Right.
But
the idea is to speed up the process to get these more of these
yeah.
through, right, Tom?
I mean, one of the complaints with the Florida foreclosure process has been it takes up to 2 years, maybe even longer, for a foreclosure to actually go through and be adjudicated. Now, on one hand, that can provide plenty of due process. On the other hand, it can also really muck up the system and slow down any kind of housing recovery or slow down the process of the homeowners and the banks to kind of unlock these situations that they've gotten themselves into.
Victoria, thanks very much for your call. Good luck. To you. You're listening to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Phil Latzman. Lively discussion on business and economy taking place with Karen Burkett from the Miami Herald and the host of our weekly business report heard Fridays on WLRN. Tom Hudson, former managing editor, co-host of the Nightly Business Report, now hosting our Sunshine Economy series, another show on Monday. Trevor Aronson, who does some award-winning work, fantastic work at the Florida Center for Investigative Reporting, co-founding that institution, and it's good to have him on the line. He's actually in Tampa, not Tallahassee. I think I said earlier he was in Tallahassee. He is now in Tampa. So this week on our series, The Sunshine Economy, a very interesting program on Monday, Tom, you spoke to leaders in South Florida's healthcare industry about the federal government data last week showing very different prices charged by 3,000 hospitals. Now, we should say, first of all, where did we get this information? How did we find out about this?
Sure. This was information that was released by the HHS, the Health and Human Services Agency, a department of the federal government that collects all of this information.
And this is from the Affordable Care Act.
This is partly from the Affordable Care Act, but the data comes from Medicare and other kind of posted retail prices for procedures. To some degree, the government was kind of shamed into this by a very lengthy article in Time magazine a few months ago, back in March, that really detailed to a to minutia degree the big disparities that it comes and the lack of transparency that exists in healthcare pricing, which has led to this debate that we've been having for the better part of a generation about trying to stem the rising tide of healthcare costs.
And the end result is that we found out in black and white print that you could get the same procedure at one hospital for five times more, maybe
easy.
Seven times more easy. Than you could at another hospital that's a few miles away.
That's right. A hip replacement in one place may cost $40,000. It may cost $250,000 at a hospital that's in the same community but servicing very different demographics. Now, the hospitals will say those are the retail posted prices. Nobody pays those prices. But the fact is, even if you don't pay that price, if you're insured either through private insurance or through Medicare, we all wind up paying for it. All consumers will wind up paying for it. So the question really is, why even have these ridiculous prices if nobody's going to pay for them? And even more to the point, why not have some transparency? And that's what we were trying to get to the heart of on Monday's program.
And on Monday's program, you spoke with Steven Sonnenreich, who mm-hmm. is Mount Sinai Medical Director, CEO. He said that transparency was so important that Mount Sinai would disclose the prices it charges as well.
You've incentivized us at Mount Sinai this morning. We will post our prices relative to Blue Cross and Aetna, our contractual prices, and we'll challenge Baptist and the other systems in the community to do the same.
But CEO Brian Keeley of Baptist Health Center, also on Monday's show, cautions that price listings are not enough.
The problem with the pricing, it is so convoluted and it's so confusing to most people, because the vast majority of people, you know, the way we are reimbursed by both Medicare, Medicaid, and commercial insurance companies mm-hmm. has very little to do with pricing. It's all pre-negotiated rates based many times on an aggregate number per stay for a diagnosis or per day, not a broken down piecemeal.
Well, my head is spinning a little bit from that response. It's still confusing.
Yeah, you can see just how complicated this is when it comes down to a very simple question when you want to go to the hospital or have to go to the ER. How much is it going to cost me? Oftentimes, you don't know until you get the bill, and that bill may not be the quote-unquote true cost. That may be the cost that your insurance provider has right. contracted with the hospital to charge or to pay. So there's so much opacity here, Phil, that we really wanted to get down to the point of, and Sonnenreich of Mount Sinai really took the first step on Monday's program and made some significant news to say, listen, he's willing to post the contracted prices, not the retail prices that the HHS released a couple of weeks ago, but the contracted prices. Here's what Blue Cross Blue Shield and Mount Sinai have agreed that this is the price this insurance carrier is going to pay for this procedure. A first big step.
Yeah, interesting. You know, a lot of people are like, well, you know, I went to the hospital to have this this MRI done, and it cost me $1,000 more because I was in the hospital and it wasn't covered by insurance. If I had done it at some offsite center,
yep.
it would have been covered totally by insurance. Yeah. But now we know those things.
Provides even more of that complexity in-network, out-of-network, sub-networks, a subcontractor. So, yeah, it's a very opaque system that we're beginning to finally see a bit transparency.
And as far as the situation with healthcare in Florida and covering the uninsured in the state, over a million people uninsured waiting on the Medicaid or some decision by the state on how to use federal funds to cover these people. No resolution, though, on how to use federal funds as part of the Affordable Care Act in Tallahassee this year. Trevor, what's the latest with this? A special session will be needed to figure this out.
Right. First, the House and the Senate need to come to a rough agreement before that special session can be called. I mean, I think what's really interesting about this gets at something Kate mentioned, which was the decline in the healthcare sector of the economy. And now the question is, how is this, you know, turning down of what was millions of dollars in the expansion of Medicaid to what would have been 1 million low-income Floridians, how is that going to affect the economy, and how many jobs might have been created had the legislature been able to kind of put politics aside and come to a reasonable agreement on how to accept the money and the best method to provide insurance to these low-income Floridians.
And they can't even agree as to whether or not they need to get back together again to resolve this, because it kicks in, I guess, January 1st, 2014. So they have to figure something out, right?
Right, but there isn't that urgency so far. I mean, obviously, you know, Bill Nelson and Rick Scott have called on them to come to a rough agreement that'll allow them to move to a special session. But really what we're seeing is kind of an obstinacy from the Florida House, which has kind of been the theme of the last legislative session, where they're just not willing to compromise very much.
Meanwhile, state legislators are keeping their premiums low for the state-subsidized health insurance while they reject Medicaid expansion. This is a story that you did at the Florida Center for Investigative Reporting.
That's right. You know, what's great is that they have what I would consider a Cadillac of plans. So they pay $8.34 a month for their very nice health insurance and for a part-time job. They can have their whole family covered for $30 a month, and that's far less than even state employees pay. And what's pretty interesting is that they chose not to bring that that rate up at a time of fiscal conservatism within the government, and at a time when they're saying, you know, sorry, 1 million Floridians, you're not going to get coverage, but we're going to keep our $8 plans and get great coverage to the state of Florida.
All right, we're going to, in just a moment, take a break and come back and talk about the budget situation, to veto or not to veto, as Governor Scott wields his pen right now. A couple of folks, though, have been waiting on the line. Let's see if we can get to them before we hit the break. Barry is in Plantation. Barry, we welcome you to the Florida Roundup. Hi.
Thank you. Hi. I have a couple of comments. First of all, I'm sure it's going to be in all the papers tomorrow. Scott's going to be taking credit for the unemployment going down.
He already has, month after month.
Right. What I want to see is someone in the press say, okay, but what type of jobs are we creating here? Real estate, I heard that the most jobs were in construction. Real estate is boom or bust, and so is hospitality and tourism. There are no real jobs in Florida. It's feast or famine. And I'd like to see someone look under the covers and say, okay, what type of jobs are they created? What's the average pay? Is it $20 an hour or more like $10 an hour?
Sounds like a job for the Florida Center for Investigative Reporting.
Yeah, actually, if I can plug FCIR, it's about a year old now, but it's still very relevant. Tristram Corton did a great story for us that put Rick Scott's job creation promises to the test and looked
That's
at
right,
how many jobs were created and how much those jobs were paid and what he showed was what the caller is alleging, which is that these are really low pay, low benefit jobs and not the great jobs that are really worth bragging about.
Yeah, we did that story here on WLRN as well, Tom.
And politically, it's a real nuanced point that is not going to be made during any election, which is just that point that Trevor made, because any incumbent can look at the unemployment rate, and if it's pointed in the right direction during election time, meaning that it's going down, that's all that matters for that campaign.
All right. Thanks, Barry, for your call, and to Jose, who's in Palm Beach
on the
topic of foreclosures. Hi, sir. Welcome.
Yeah, I'm in favor of HB 87. Due to the fact I work for a property managing company, and I see how the banks have left the houses. They haven't taken title to them, and they're abandoned for 2 or 3 years, and they're an eyesore for the rest of the community. So the other homeowners are paying for it in their fees for the maintenance and upkeep.
Great. Well, we balanced that out. Thank you. Thanks very much. One for and one against. Thank you very much, Jose.
Okay.
All right. This is the Florida Roundup. Good discussion we're having here. Karen Burkett from the Miami Herald. And WLRN, Tom Hudson, special correspondent for WLRN. Also with us is Trevor Aronson from the Florida Center for Investigative Reporting. I'm Phil Latz. We'll come back and talk about Don Vito and whether the governor will veto, what he'll veto, possibly tuition and some other stuff. So stay with us. The conversation continues, and we'll get into some local and regional stuff as well. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Phil Latzman. And our guests, Tom Hudson, Karen Burkett, and Trevor Aronson. You can join the conversation as well. We do have a live discussion being curated by our social media editor, Danny Rivero, working very hard, facing computer right now, to respond to anything that you have. And the conversation will continue off the air. That is on our website, WLRN.org. We're also tweetable at @WLRN. We'd like to keep the conversation going anytime, not just between noon and 1 or on Saturday mornings, anytime on our website or through social media. Now, on the veto situation, the governor has until a week from today to act on the budget, although I think he's going away, so he may do it before then. He could veto some individual spending items in the budget. Trevor, do we have a sense of what the governor is likely to put his pen to line item veto out of this $74.5 billion budget?
Hope that he might consider some of the more ridiculous projects that were given money. You know, for example, There, $1 million was advocated for a Bay of Pigs museum in Miami. $4 million for a movie to a sequel to the movie Dolphin Tale about the dolphin at the Clearwater Marine Aquarium who had a prosthetic fin put on. You know, the very corny but heartwarming movie, if you will, but certainly questionable if it's worth $4 million in state taxpayer money. And so certainly there's a lot of kind of pork barrel projects that have been thrown into this budget that I'd hope were the beginning of where Rick Scott would look in trying to veto some of the spending.
Now, we have the Florida Tax Watch every year, I think for the past 30 years, has listed its quote-unquote turkeys from the Florida budget. This week it came out with that, listing $104 million in turkey projects, if you will. 18 Miami-Dade projects making this annual list from the group yesterday. That's far more than any other county. They include $1.5 million for the Miami Project to Cure Paralysis, which we all know has done some very terrific work there in advancement to cure paralysis. Also, $1 million each for a jobs program for children with disabilities championed by former Dolphins quarterback Dan Marino, a social services center in Southwest Dade, and as Trevor mentioned, the Bay of Pigs Museum. So these are things that every year we come out with these things, but there are local projects that are important to people, and depending how you look at them.
Yes, the state legislatures will have these pet projects, there's no doubt. But to an earlier point, Trevor, that you were making about economic incentives, I mean, these are dollars that possibly could be spent in other ways or not spent at all. And you have to ask, are they distorting the market here? Are they crowding out other folks that may have dollars that they'd like to put toward these projects?
And one of the major things as far as vetoes, back to that, Governor Rick Scott hinted he may veto the 3% tuition increase as he considers the budget lawmakers sent him earlier this month. He spoke with reporters in Tallahassee and said tuition in Florida has gone up 70% in the past 5 years.
And I worry about families like mine growing up that didn't have a lot of money for tuition. So I'm going to go through the budget very carefully, like I've done the last 2 years. But as you know, I've not supported a tuition increase.
University officials say they expect a veto, and Charlie Crist used the line item veto to reject tuition increases a few years ago, and they say that gives Governor Scott the ability to do that. So that's one thing. Is there a sense, Karen, that the cost of higher education in Florida is high or too low, rather?
I wouldn't say it's too low. I mean, the average student loan debt is $26,000, and there aren't jobs for many of these kids coming out of college, young adults coming out of college. Yeah. It's a challenge. It's a different time.
I think there's two things to consider here, Phil. One is that student college loans are larger than credit card debt nationally. And the second thing is there's a big brain drain that's happened with Florida. We've educated a lot of students and they go elsewhere for these good paying jobs to what the caller alluded to earlier. So you got to keep education affordable and then create that infrastructure so that these young adults coming out of school will want to stay in Florida.
And ironically, this week you also found out about how much Florida's 28 college presidents are making. They are earning millions in salaries and benefits. The report released by the Inspector General's office shows that Florida's state college presidents received a combined $9.8 million in salaries and benefits during the fiscal year. State law allows taxpayer money to cover only about $225,000 of a college president's salary, but individual colleges can augment that base salary. The highest compensation package goes to the president of Miami-Dade College, Eduardo Padron, with a total exceeding $630,000. But there would be a lot of people who would say he really deserves that because of the growth and his leadership in making Miami-Dade College such a success.
And it's the largest community college in the country. So he is managing he thinks very much like an economist in terms of picking out what is going to be successful. He saw an interest, let's say, in the culinary arts, and he developed a program there. So he's pretty strategic.
And Trevor, one final note on education, at least the K-12 education. A company called K-12, which operates in 43 districts in Florida, including Miami-Dade and Broward, here in South Florida, teaching everything from art to algebra to students in kindergarten through high school. And you at FCIR, as part of the great reporting you've done, have done some reporting about this company and some questions.
Right. This is a K-12 Incorporated is a publicly traded company and one of the largest beneficiaries of the expansion of online education in local public school districts. And what we found is that the K-12 was using teachers that did not have the proper subject certification. In Florida, teachers have to have a general certification as well as a subject certification. And K-12 teachers did not, in some cases, did not have that subject certification. And there are emails that we obtained that showed that the company was asking other employees who had the proper certification to help cover up this practice by signing for teaching classes that they did not teach. The Department of Education IG's office did an investigation of this, and they attributed it to paperwork errors, that this was not, according to the IG, K-12's willful intention to subvert the law, and it just ended up being a result of sloppy paperwork in 2011. Since then, John O'Connor at State Impact Florida and I obtained an internal recording of a K-12 meeting where in 2009 they're talking about doing this, the very same thing, you know, not using teachers that did not have the proper certifications. And so the question is, if this was just a paperwork error, that paperwork error persisted at K-12 for 3 years, which is a little bit hard to believe. And I think what this gets at are the real questions of, you know, when you're privatizing large parts of public education, you know, what prices are we going to pay? And what we're seeing at K-12 is perhaps in trying to boost its profits, you know, cutting corners a little bit with teacher certification.
You can read all about that at FCIR.org and along with the other stuff that Trevor does at Florida Center for Investigative Reporting. You are listening to the Florida Roundup. I'm Phil Latzman. It's Trevor Aronson from the Florida Center for Investigative Reporting. Tom Hudson with us here from WLRN Miami Herald News, host of the Sunshine Economy series. Karen Burkett, host of our weekly business report, heard every Friday, and also with the Miami Herald. We've got to move into this topic because this is something that came up this week about the internet gambling laws in Florida. When is a gambling machine not a gambling machine? Apparently, when it's located inside of a children's arcade, state lawmakers and local officials were quick to push through a law this year that shut down most senior arcades. Of course, in the wake of a scandal involving the lieutenant governor, who'd done some consulting work for one of the companies that was doing this illegally. It appears, though, that those actions to banish these gambling machines, the maquinitas, as they're called in Miami-Dade County, do not extend to the popular kiddie arcades, say the Chuck E. Cheese's of the world, the Dave and Buster's. Apparently, the prizes must be merchandise. They can't be worth more than 75 cents. And we asked for your view on this because a lot of people, after this law was passed, said, hey, well, you know, what are we doing? We went to these senior arcades. We were trying to have a good time. Now they outlawed those. But what about Chuck E. Cheese? What about, you know, those kiddie arcades? And we had some feedback from our audience on this. So first of all, Tom, this seems like a real conundrum. I mean, didn't they think about this before they passed this
law? Well, you know, that's a rhetorical question at this point, Phil, I think. But listen, I've had some high-stake games of whack-a-mole, so I can understand why legislators would really want to put a blanket kind of policy here. I think, listen, what we're seeing here is the law of unintended consequences, right? I think legislators and regulators wanting to respond to a public policy hole and trying to really wallpaper over that with something.
Move too quickly.
Perhaps this is an area, obviously, where it can be nuanced and you can wind up really costing yourself some constituents or at least some young constituents who aren't be able to win at skee ball any longer.
All right. Skee ball's my favorite, by the way. All right. And we have some folks through the Public Insight Network that have some opinions on that, some strong opinions. Jenny is in Hialeah. She's a former owner of Maquinita, a senior arcade in Miami-Dade County. Jenny, welcome to the Florida Roundup.
Hi, how are you?
Good. So how does that make you feel when you see the Chuck E. Cheese and Dave & Buster's and those places still operating?
Okay, I want to clarify. I have an arcade amusement center, so it's like a Chuck E. Cheese place or a Dave & Buster's.
Oh, okay. So you are, all right. Different. So it's the other way around then. So do you feel that there's a dichotomy there? Do you feel there's a conflict?
There is a conflict because my clients are seniors and their clients are kids. So to my understanding, the law never specifies or excludes any exceptions, like, for example, separating the kiddie arcades to the adult arcades. So, yes, there has been a discrimination done, and I think the government, the legislators, and the law enforcement should do something about it, and I haven't seen any results.
Has it affected your business? I mean, are you now out of business?
Yes.
Yeah.
I am out of business, like from one day to another. Like today I was legal, and once the governor signed the bill, right away, I was unemployed. I had paid for licenses and everything, and they didn't even let us finish the term or give us, like, a couple of days for us, you know, like, to tell our employees that they're going to be unemployed. So, yes, it has been a huge mess.
Well, Jenny, thanks very much. Good luck to you in your future endeavors. We appreciate you reaching out to us today.
Okay, thank you.
All right, now, Richard is in Miami, and he also has some relation to this. I think you said your grandmother used to go to these adult arcades, and she's got no place to go now? Or tell us about why you think this was a bad idea, Richard.
Yeah, exactly. My grandmother, she used to enjoy going to these adult arcades, you know, just for entertainment. And now all of a sudden they're shut down. And it's just because the law is extremely vague and it's just incorrect. The majority of these arcades were centers of entertainment, and they classified them as gambling. And that's just incorrect. Same with the Maquinitas. They weren't gambling machines. They were entertainment machines.
Right.
And yet they just threw them in with gambling. And I personally think the casinos have to do they have a lot to do with this. Just like last week, the Herald published their profits, which were exceeding like $3 billion.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, no one does anything to regulate the casinos.
Right. I think it would have been...
But these poor mom-and-pop stores and these arcades that were for entertainment just get shut down.
Right.
Just to benefit another larger corporation.
All right. Well, Richard, thanks very much for the call. We're going to move on because there are a couple of things I do want to get to here before we end the show, and we're running up against it. But we found out this week, Karen, that the Dolphins plan to modernize Sun Life Stadium, which was killed in Tallahassee because they never got to vote on it, may have been doomed at the polls anyway because people went to early vote before that got killed in Tallahassee. And we found out about 57% opposed the stadium makeover. Only 43% supported it. So you think this means this was all a complete pointless effort?
Marlins.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah.
That's it.
Just blame the Marlins.
I just feel like that, you know, that was a predecessor. So I just don't think that the public is particularly comfortable with that idea.
By the way, the Dolphins spent $10 million on this referendum, and they got, I think, about 25,000 votes, if I'm not correct. But $356 per vote they spent, which is amazing.
There was always a big Marlin in the room when it came to the Dolphin Stadium issue, wasn't there?
Yeah, and the Super Bowls 50 and 51 will be awarded next week. So we'll see if that makes a difference. And one other note, I wanted to leave with this. South Florida could lose a Super Bowl to the San Francisco Bay Area. It could also lose one of its iconic museums and aquatic facilities. Now, I was looking for something to go along with this today, and I found this, an excerpt from a newsreel in 1977.
The International Swimming Hall of Fame proudly presents the biggest single day in its history, February 24th, 1977. The day Gerald R. Ford was inducted as an honorary member of the Hall of Fame. The president, a former football player, now a golfer on tour, has revealed swimming to be his favorite exercise. No weekend swimmer he, the president tries to swim each and every day, and has long favored an each and every child swimmer program for American school children.
And time marches on. That's a newsreel documenting President Ford's visit to the International Swimming Hall of Fame in Fort Lauderdale 36 years ago. We're finding out this week they may move to Santa Clara, California. The place just built this stadium that's competing against South Florida for the Super Bowl 50 bid. It says it will raise $2 million to support the move, $10 million to move it to the West Coast. Fort Lauderdale and the Swimming Hall not getting along here. This would be amazing if they were to lose the Swimming Hall of Fame to California. This is like an iconic place. We just heard the newsreel there. It's amazing.
The coldest summer you'll ever spend will be swimming in Santa Clara, California, not Fort Lauderdale.
It's true. The water is colder there. I don't know if they know that. And we also want to just say this before we leave, the farewell to the Miami Herald building. It's sort of interesting, just on a last note, because of the future of resort casino gambling on that site is now in focus. You know, a nice story today in the Herald about it. They, of course, acted quickly, the legislators, to eliminate internet gambling. They shut down these arcades. I think in a couple of words, Karen, that's bad news for the Malaysian company Genting, which bought this property with hopes of turning it into a resort casino.
Possibly. You know, they're trying to phase this thing in. So they're a little bit more temperate in their approach. Now, we'll see what happens.
Well, we'll miss that Miami Herald building. Best place that I ever worked. Spent 10 years of my life there. So farewell to the building. Thanks, Karen Burkett. 5:45 this afternoon. You heard daily business report.
Thank you, weekly Phil.
Business report.
Thank
Great
you.
To have you back. Tom Hudson, Monday at 9 a.m. for the Sunshine Economy on real estate.
My pleasure,
and
Phil.
And Trevor Aronson, FCIR.org for all his great investigative work with the Florida Center for Investigative Reporting. Thank you, sir.
Thanks, Phil.
And that does it for the Florida Roundup this Friday, May 17th, 2013. If you missed any part of the show, we do have it again on these airwaves on Saturday mornings at 6 a.m. We also post it on our website at WLRN.org. The Florida Roundup is produced by Elaine Chen and Alicia Zuckerman. Our Public Insight Network analyst, Steph Farrell, got us her feedback today. Our social media editor, Danny Rivero, online with the conversation that continues at WLRN.org. The executive producer for WLRN, handling the operations today, is Peter J. Meritz. For WLRN Miami Herald News, Dan Gretsch. Our technical supervisor, Paul Leary. South Florida Arts Beat is next. Thanks for listening. Until next week, I'm Phil Latzman, and stay informed, South Florida.